Hey, good morning everyone, and welcome to the second part of Mindfulness and Relationships. I just want to, before we start, and I'll try and remind everyone at the end as well, this is the last one of the series and also the last one of this term. So we are going to take a break now for 2 weeks, and the next Thursday morning will be on the 23rd of July. I'm working on the topic, so I will send around the topic when I'm confirmed. I just wanted to mention, things are a bit uncertain at the moment because some things are opening up, but with limitations. My suspicion is that this particular session for next term will remain on Zoom and Facebook for the time being, just because it's a large group and at Binah it will be a problem with social distancing and so on and so forth. There are many things of Binah that will remain on Zoom anyway, and some shiurim, some sessions will go back to the premises. I'm mentioning that because I'm just asking everyone just to look out for the notifications and just pay attention to the details to know. But I think this particular session, the Thursday morning class, will remain online for the time being. So just to review a little bit from last week, we started talking about the concept of mindfulness and relationships. And we gave a particular focus last week to the idea of empathy. So the idea of empathy is the ability to understand the world of the other, to really connect to the world of the other, what the person is feeling, to really participate in the person's challenge, to celebrate in the person's happiness, and so on and so forth. So Rabbi Sacks, we mentioned an article last week, Rabbi Sacks talks about the warning of the Torah to not to mistreat a stranger, because you were strangers. In other words, the Torah is emphasizing the need for empathy on someone who went through perhaps similar experiences that we went through, so we should be able to understand and appreciate what they've been through. And he asked the question about, you're not supposed to mistreat anyone, so why does the Torah emphasize the stranger? And he explains, because it's easier to have empathy with someone that's close, but harder when it's someone who's disconnected to us and is a stranger. To which we added last week, and we said, well, we're living in a time now that even those that are close to us are becoming strangers because of our distracted mind, because of technology, because of the fragmentation of the mind, that we're rushing from one thing to another, we're not focused, we're not paying attention, and therefore we stop noticing even people who are living with us and even people who are very close to us. We stop noticing and we stop therefore being able to really tap into what they're experiencing. And we talked about the study that was done in the States about that people who were rushing type people, that they rushed all the time, they had less empathy, there was a reduction in empathy, and they didn't stop to help someone even though it was the topic of their presentation that they were going to give. So noticing and being aware of someone else, being sensitive to the feelings of someone else, all of this strengthens relationships, and therefore learning the art of being present and noticing and paying attention, which is really the essence of mindfulness, is so important when it comes to strengthening healthy relationships. So today I want to just start off by just adding something beautiful that I read this week. It's an interesting take, it's an interesting interpretation of a law that's found in the Talmud, which I always wondered about that law, exactly what it means. And this week, just in relation to this, there's a beautiful book just came out recently called Mindfulness, A Jewish Approach, written by Jonathan Finer. Some great stuff in there. Reference to great studies and articles and so on. It's very good. And he talks a little bit about mindfulness and relationships as well. And he quotes a ruling in the Talmud. And I'll just explain it to you. The Talmud discourages people when they walk to take... It says one should always walk in a way where you take normal steps. But one shouldn't run. One shouldn't take big steps. Right? In other words, because you're in a rush, so you take big steps and you walk quickly. The Talmud discourages that. And in fact, the Talmud says that taking long steps or running, taking the steps in a running sort of motion, It takes away one five hundredth of eyesight. That's what the Talmud says. I'm not sure what the biological, physiological application of that is, but that's what it says. It says taking long steps takes away 1/500th of a person's eyesight. And then the Talmud continues and says, how do you restore that eyesight? By drinking the Friday night Kiddush. Others say it's also got to do with looking at the candles on Friday night. That's why when you make Kiddush on Friday night, there's also a custom that the person making Kiddush looks at the Shabbat candles, the burning Shabbat candles before he starts to make Kiddush. And that's the way the eyesight comes back. And I always wondered what the connection was. What's the connection between, first of all, why does running big steps take away a person's eyesight? And also, what's the connection between restoring the eyesight and the Kiddush on Shabbat? And he brings a very, very beautiful explanation. He says it symbolizes something very important. Taking big steps is the idea that we spoke about last week, the idea of rushing. Rushing and therefore not noticing, not seeing the world of another, not appreciating the emotions and the feelings of another person or what they're going through. Which is perhaps exactly what the Talmud means when it says that running weakens your eyesight. In other words, rushing from one thing to another weakens your ability to see figuratively, to see, not to see physiologically, but to see the other person, to notice the other person, to observe what the other person is going through. So the Talmud says, what is the remedy for this? And the Talmud says the remedy is to drink the Kiddush on Friday night, a hint to the concept of Shabbat. Shabbat is about stopping. Shabbat is about being rather than rushing to do from one thing to another. Shabbat is a time that we stop and we internalize, we reflect, we pause, and we're able to be, we're able to notice, we're able to be connect with others. So this is the deeper explanation, exactly what we spoke about last week, that rushing allows you not to see the other person properly. Whereas Shabbat is the antidote. Shabbat is that time that we're supposed to stop, calm down, tap into the beauty and the rhythm and the holiness of Shabbat, and just reflect on who we are, start to notice, start to become aware, and start to observe both ourselves and others. And that's why the remedy to the loss of eyesight, so to speak, from running, from taking big steps, is the concept of Shabbat. Now, we also explained last week, and I'm just going to connect it to something that the Kotzker Rebbe said, and that is that we know that in Judaism, and I think I might have mentioned this briefly last week, but I just wanted to sort of pick up on it. In Judaism, we have a trait that is glorified, and it's called Zrizut. Zrizut means not to procrastinate. Not to put things off, not to delay, but to act with alacrity, to act soon, to go for it, to be quick on the mark. In other words, to do things as soon as we can. So we find examples of this very often in Torah teaching. So for example, we find that Avraham Avinu, when he was given the mitzvah of the Akedah, the mitzvah to take his son and offer him up on the altar, by Yashkem Avraham Baboker, the Pasuk says he woke up in the morning early. He didn't put it off. As difficult as it was, he could have said, you know, another few hours with my son. Who said I have to do it in the morning? Maybe I can do it in the afternoon. Maybe I can do it the next day. No, he didn't do that. He right away jumped into it and he did it right away. We have the mitzvah when a person has a bris, when a person has a circumcision. There's a mitzvah to try and do the circumcision on the eighth day, but in the morning of the eighth day. If you can't, if the mohel is not available, then it's different. You do it in the afternoon, but to try and do it as early as possible. A concept of zrizut, not procrastinating, not putting things off. As the Talmud says, mitzvah habaliyatcha, if a mitzvah comes your way, al tachmitzena, do not let it sour, do not let it sit until you sort of spoil the whole experience, but do it right away. So that's just a concept of zrizut, concept of alacrity. However, this thing that we talk about, calmness, patience, slowing down, not rushing, could superficially seem almost contradictory to the concept of zrizut, but it certainly isn't. In fact, they're complementary. Because the Kotzker Rebbe writes the following. He says, a patient person, a matun as he calls it in Hebrew, is one that acts with a settled mind. And therefore, a person who acts with a settled mind doesn't hurry things. He says that actually it's a lazy person that is the opposite, because a lazy person doesn't actually have patience to settle himself. That is interesting. You see, acting calmly, patience, calming down, noticing, being aware, and acting sort of slowly, actually takes effort. The effort it takes is to be fully present, to immerse yourself in the experience. That takes time, and it takes effort, and it takes calmness. A lazy person does both things. A lazy person puts things off, but also acts in a rush. In other words, a lazy person is all over the place. A lazy person is fragmented. A lazy person doesn't have the power, the koach, to be present and to calm down. So what does a lazy person know? What does a lazy person do? One of two things. Either he puts things off and never does them, or he gets it out of the way quickly and he acts impulsively. So on the contrary, sometimes when people rush things and they do it impulsively, that is a sign of a lazy person, not a sign of a person who's acting with rizut, right? You see, because patience actually allows us to be fully present to what we are. Being present in where we are and what we're doing allows us to fully focus on what we're doing to the exclusion of other things. And it also allows us that when we finish doing what we're doing, we stop doing it and we get right onto the next thing. Not in a rushed way, but just to move with in a non-procrastinating way. So in other words, on the contrary, people who do not procrastinate, people who act with rizut, people who get right onto a mitzvah or right onto something that they're supposed to do, they don't get onto it to rush it. They get onto it because now it's time to do it. They put in the effort to be fully immersed in that experience. And in fact, on the contrary, experience that experience with calmness. You know, you have people who, I mean, we do this, we see this in so many different areas. So the people who rush their prayer, for example, it's not because they efficient people and they get things done. On the contrary, you find a person who rushes prayer as the same person who comes late and doesn't know where they are. And it's the same person that gets distracted after the prayer and schmoozes with his friend for half an hour and then realizes, oh yeah, I'm late for an appointment, right? Because it's a fragmented mind. A fragmented mind puts things off. A fragmented mind doesn't want to get into things properly that are difficult. The person who's efficient is actually the patient person. It's an interesting thing. People think that rushing creates efficiency. Rushing doesn't. Rushing doesn't create efficiency. Rushing creates loss of focus. And therefore, efficiency is actually created by slowing down, being fully immersed, and finishing something and saying goodbye to it and getting right on to the next thing, because we're not scared to get into a new experience calmly and with immersion and being fully present. Okay, so I want to just, that was sort of finishing off what we said last week. Now, I want to just explore this a little bit, just to understand on a bit of a deeper level why it is that being mindful actually strengthens our relationships. And what does actually being mindful mean in this level, tying it into what I often refer to as Jewish mindfulness, which is mindfulness perhaps on a deeper level. And I want to do this with introducing to you, just sharing with you a concept which I often think about that could happen to a person when we talk about areas of personal growth, personal development, and so on. What we find often, not often, but sometimes, with people who are very focused on personal development and personal growth, including things like mindfulness, personal development training, and so on and so forth, that actually it's an amazing thing, but sometimes it actually backfires in a strange way. Now, I'm certainly not recommending that we don't focus on personal growth, because in 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time, we start the new session, we'll have an empty Zoom. So I certainly encourage, and I've been doing this for many years, as you know, personal growth. Growth in general is the basis of human experience. We should always reflect. We should always pursue. We should always learn. We should always study, and we should always explore new things so that we can grow, go beyond our comfort zone, become more aware of ourselves, become more conscious, become more mindful, and grow as a human being. However, it can happen, and it does happen, that sometimes when people are very focused on personal growth, it actually backfires and leads to a mindset of egocentricity. Right? Because anything that focuses on self, even if it's a good thing like personal, like self-growth, has the danger of becoming all about self. Okay? Let me say that again. Anything that focuses on self has the danger of becoming about the self. So it can become a whole process where it's all about self-preservation. It's about being aware of our own needs, which can often get in the way of healthy relationships. It's about becoming focusing on self. And I've heard this from people a lot of times. You know, they've learned that, you know, you can't be a shmata, you can't be walked over, which is all true. They've learned about self-esteem. Then they learned that, you need to take a break, you need to take care of yourself, well-being, which is all true. But sometimes that becomes the slant. It's also all about that I need to be healthy. I need to feel good about myself. I need to do things when they feel right. I shouldn't feel that someone's imposing on me. And so on and so forth. And it actually can sometimes lead to people taking things very, very seriously. And I say that because it leads into the discussion I want to have about mindfulness. Because self-growth, personal growth generally, includes things like self-awareness, self-esteem, understanding our own needs, being in touch with our own emotions, and so on and so forth. But it needs to come with humility, and it needs to come with a goal, and the goal is not about self. It includes understanding self, but the goal actually of personal growth is to go beyond self. It's to go beyond our comfort zone. It's not to take ourselves so seriously. The purpose of personal growth is to not take up so much space that I cannot include someone else, that I cannot make room for another person, that I stop noticing the other person because I'm self-absorbed, because I'm focusing on self all the time. You know, we find this principle, we're coming up not so long from now to the month of Elul, which is called Chodesh HaCheshbon. It's the preparation month to Rosh Hashanah, where we are taught that's the month of reflection, it's the month of stock-taking, it's the month of to make what we call in Hebrew a Cheshbon HaNefesh. And those who write about the concept of Cheshbon explain how critical it is for a person to stop every so often and to actually reflect on what I did yesterday, what I did last month, what I did in the last year, what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, what do I need to improve? Because if we never stop and reflect about our values and about where we're up to, and we go through a very healthy audit of where we are up to in our own experience, we will never grow. So we have to identify those weaknesses, we have to feel uncomfortable with them, we have to let them go, we have to improve, and so on. So self-reflection is so important. In fact, we're supposed to do this every day for a few minutes at night, we're supposed to do it every week, we're supposed to do it every month, but we're certainly supposed to do it once a year during the month of Elul. That's the whole concept of Tshuva and Yom Kippur and so on and so forth. But the very same masters of self-growth in Jewish literature warn us that stock-taking, self-reflection must only be done at designated times. Because if we keep reflecting on ourselves, if we keep reflecting what we have been doing and where we're up to, we just end up being all about ourselves. And therefore they say that there's a month of Elul where we spend time reflecting. There's a few minutes each night when we say the bedtime Shema, and we spend time reflecting. But other than that, we just got to get on with the job. Get on with doing mitzvot, get on with giving to other people, getting on with strengthening our relationships with other people and with God, and so on and so forth, right? So personal growth is not about self, it's going beyond self. In fact, personal growth is about freedom of ourselves, from our own prison, from our own trap. However, to grow, you need to understand yourself, yes. So we spend some time in understanding ourselves. We understand some time on getting in touch with our own emotions, to know where we're up to, identify our strengths and weaknesses, to understand the self-worth, and so on and so forth. But it should never become about ourselves. Now, I mention that because that danger, I mean, this is true always, nothing to do with this topic. But the reason that I mention is because that danger of self-absorption in pursuing the area of personal growth gets to the heart of what we've been talking about, that we stop noticing other people. And we stop noticing, we notice and we're very aware of ourselves, but we stop becoming aware of others. And we stop becoming aware of what others need and what others are feeling. Right. So being mindful has the same danger. When we talk about mindfulness is about awareness. In fact, mindfulness is a lot about self. It's about being aware. I notice my breath. I notice the taste in food. I notice the moment that I'm in. I'm aware where I'm at. I'm experiencing the experience properly. And if you read some mindfulness literature, it's a lot about self. It's a lot about, but it, you know, it introduces a calmness. Normally it helps relationships too, but it's not about relationships so much. And yet we're talking about that actually the art of mindfulness should expand. Not only becoming self-aware, but becoming aware of others. Noticing others. Noticing what's going on around us. Noticing what others need and feel. And how do we do this? So part of it is about understanding the depth of mindfulness. And we've talked about this many times, but let's revisit this. Mindfulness is not only becoming aware of self. It's not only about feeling and noticing how we breathe and how we feel and being present in a situation and an experience. But mindfulness is becoming aware of the deeper self. It's becoming aware of the layer which is deeper than the surface. It's becoming aware of what is at the core essence of the human beings, becoming aware of what the core essence and the purpose of the experience is. And with ourselves, it means becoming aware of our soul, becoming aware of the neshama, becoming aware of the godliness which is within us, becoming aware of the selflessness which is within us, becoming aware of the purity and the meaning and the purpose and the pursuit of meaning and purpose which is within us. And it's when we become aware of that deeper self, when we reflect and we meditate and we talk about becoming conscious not only of the surface, not only of the superficial world, but conscious of the what is beneath the surface. We tap into the core essence of who we are. We tap into that selflessness which is in us, and that allows us to make room for others. It allows us not only to notice ourselves, but to notice others at the same time. It allows us not to become self-absorbed. It allows us to become about meaning and purpose. It allows us about becoming someone who's pursuing something beyond ourselves and understanding the worth and the value of strong relationships and generosity and kindness and good deeds toward others, and therefore becoming aware and noticing the other people. So take us a little bit, just a step deeper. There's a very famous chapter in the book of Tanya where he discusses, it's known as the Perek Lev, the 32nd chapter, where he discusses the mitzvah of Ahavat Yisrael, the mitzvah that the Torah tells us, V'ahavta l're'acha kamocha. Love your neighbor as you love yourself, as the common translation goes. And he asks the famous question, can you really love someone like yourself? Let's be honest. You can love someone, but can you really love them as you love yourself? And we're not talking about selfish love. We're not talking about only someone that you really like. And even then it's very hard. We're talking about someone that you don't even necessarily know that well. It applies to all people. V'ahavta l're'acha kamocha. How do you do that? How do you reach that level of really connecting to someone as you would connect to yourself, to care about someone as you would care for yourself? Is that really possible? Is that humanly possible? Can a human being do that? After all, we're different. After all, my interests are different to your interests. My goals, my needs are different to your needs. How do I care for you as I would care for you, for ourselves? And he explains it in the following way. He says, by preface of another question, which I'm going to share with you, a very beautiful idea. There's a famous story in the Talmud about a potential convert who came to Shammai and he came to Hillel. Shammai and Hillel were the two greats around the end of the Second Temple, two great leaders. But they were different. Shammai was more gevurah, he was more strict, he was more harsh. Hillel was more chesed, as we are taught. So the non-Jew, the potential convert, goes to Shammai and he says, I would like to convert. But the condition is, you know, when you convert, you have to really learn. You have to learn the Torah, you have to learn about the mitzvot. So he says, but I want to learn the entire Torah while standing on one foot. And Shammai essentially dismisses him. And says, you know, that's ridiculous. So he goes to Hillel. And he says, Hillel, I would like to convert on the condition that I learn the entire Torah on one foot. And Hillel says the following, Ma da'alach sani l'chavroch l'tavid, what you don't like, don't do to your friend. In other words, treat someone else as you would treat yourself. That is the entire Torah, he says. The rest is commentary. Now go and learn the commentary. In other words, he didn't accept him for conversion right away. He says, you want to know the Torah on one foot? This is the Torah on one foot. Now go learn the commentary. So the Tanya asks the following question. He says, the Torah we know is divided into two parts, which from a Torah point of view are equally important. The mitzvot between what we call ben Adam l'makom, between man and God, and the mitzvot ben Adam l'chavro, between man and man. In other words, the mitzvot that are more spiritual, that connect us straight to God, like tefillin, writing Shabbos candles, prayer, and so on and so forth. Then there's the mitzvot between us and other people. Be kind, give charity, don't steal, don't embarrass, and so on and so forth. It's the two tablets that were given to us in Shavuot, right? The two tablets. The first tablet is more between man and God. The second tablet is between man and man. And there's two equal tablets because we are taught they're equally important. If one wants to be a Jew connected to God, if one wants to be someone who's going to bring godliness into the world, if we want to fulfill our mission on this planet, we have to engage in both parts of the Torah, between man and man and man and God. If we leave out one to the exclusion of the other, that becomes highly problematic. Either one. So, he asks the question, he says, I understand if you tell me that the large body of literature in the Torah, which talks about the mitzvot between man and man, that that's based on one principle. Ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha, loving someone like yourself, I get that. Because that's the foundation. If I care for someone else like I care for myself, I won't steal and I won't be embarrassed, I won't humiliate and I will be generous and I will give charity and so on and so forth. But what does that mitzvah of loving someone else like yourself have to do with the mitzvot between man and God? What does it have to do with putting on tefillin? What does it have to do with lighting a Shabbos candle? What does it have to do with the prayer of the Amidah? What does it have to do with, I don't know, shaking a lulav, sitting in a sukkah? What's that got to do with that mitzvah? And he says it's very simple. Well, it's not simple to implement, but it's simple to talk about. He says the following. He said any mitzvah between man and man or man and God comes from the following thing. It comes that we give priority to our soul over our body. In other words, we've all got two forces. We've talked about this many times. We've all got two forces. Now, you'll see where I'm going with this in a minute in terms of being aware of the deeper self and so on. But we've all got two forces. We've got the godly force and the animal force. The godly force motivates us and pushes us to be spiritual, to be godly, to be selfless, whereas the animal force, as we know, motivates us to be selfish, egocentric, and self-absorbed and not in pursuit of meaning, but rather in pursuit of pleasure. Right? We've talked about this many times. So therefore, for a person to be a godly person, to a person to serve God on any level, between man and man or man and God, it requires being in touch with our soul. It requires being in touch with our godly soul. It requires being in touch with that part of us that is godly, that will motivate us to live a life of higher meaning and purpose. However, what is the pathway to giving priority and becoming conscious and focusing on the godliness of our soul rather than on the animalistic energy that we have within us? It's the mitzvah of Ahavat Yisrael. It's the mitzvah of Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha. Why? Because this is the answer to the question. You can only love someone like yourself. You can only care deeply for someone else as you would care for yourself. If you don't look at the superficial of the person, if you don't look at the body of the person, but you look at his or her soul. Because on the superficial part of existence, as far as our body is concerned, as part of our animal soul is concerned, we are all dramatically different. And my animal soul, my physical structure does not want to care for you as I care for myself, because we are so different, we have different needs, we have different pursuits, we have different interests, we have different perspectives. And therefore, I cannot be connected to you as I'm connected to myself. Mostly because my animal soul anyway, my body, my physical focus in my being, in my personality, self-absorbed. Why should I be interested in you anyway? However, when I look beyond this superficial, when I look beyond who I am just superficially and I look deeply and I become aware of my own soul and I decide to give my soul the focus, I decide to give mastery over my godly, to my godly soul, over my animal energy. And I realize what that soul is, that soul is godly, that soul is pure, that soul is selfless. And I realize that soul, once I've realized my depth, I realize it's exactly identical to your depth. Because our souls are all connected. Our souls are all part of a godly energy that God has given each and every one of us. Yes, our souls manifest itself a bit differently. They manifest itself with different needs, interests, and perspectives, but at their core essence, they're all exactly the same. Each one of our souls has that same spark at its very depth, at its very foundation, that seeks meaning, that seeks purpose, that seeks selflessness. And therefore, when I start to give dominance and mastery to my soul over my body, that's when I can do both kinds of mitzvot. That's when I can do both kinds of mitzvot, which is the mitzvot between man and man, mitzvot between man and God, because I'm now a soul person rather than an animal person. And when you're a soul person, you serve God on all levels. So therefore, the Hillel turned to the convert and said, no problem. Just understand one principle. And the principle is, love someone else like yourself. What I'm really telling you is, says Hillel, you cannot do that unless you give dominance to your soul over your body. Unless you give mastery to your godly energy over your animal instincts. And when you do that, you become a person who is a soul. A soul person. When you're a soul person, you're selfless. You make room for others. You understand that everyone is really connected at its core to the same meaning and purpose. And when you become a soul purpose, that is the foundation of the entire Torah. So the rest is all commentary between man and matter, between man and God. Go learn it and go study it. So going back to the principle we said before, even mindfulness for ourselves, even mindfulness for our own personal growth, has to be deeper mindfulness. Learning to become aware means not just learning to pay attention to what we're doing and what we're eating and what we're feeling and the sensations in our body that we feel. Being mindful goes deeper means becoming aware of our inner self, becoming aware of our inner essence, becoming aware of the deeper self. And when we become aware of the deeper self, that's when we don't run the risk of personal growth becoming self-absorbed and egocentric. On the contrary, we become more selfless, we become more obsessed or interested in going beyond ourselves, in freeing ourselves from ourselves, and therefore we're also able to notice, once we will notice the depth within ourselves, we're able to notice the depth within someone else. And that's where enhanced relationships become possible, strengthening relationships become possible, empathy becomes possible, understanding, noticing, and really tapping into the other, the world of the other, becomes possible. Because if I focus on my superficial, I become very self-absorbed and it's all about me. There's no space for others. But if I become aware of the deeper self, then I'm able to see the depth within everything and make room for all our depths, because all our depths is really all the same. And therefore be able to notice not only what's happening with me, to be presence not only in my world, but to be present in your world as well, and to create that stronger relationship by connecting to each other. So in summary, therefore, of that point, mindfulness is about paying attention, by paying attention to the inner self, which allows us to go beyond our superficial self. Now, I want to just mention a couple of things on a practical note. You see, this concept that when we practice mindfulness, we practice the art of noticing and becoming aware, especially to the inner self and the deeper presence of who we are. So we create that mindset of noticing and being aware on a deeper level, and therefore it enhances all concepts of relationships and strengthening our relationships. So this plays out in a lot of different ways on a very practical note. One very interesting thing, and I think I mentioned this briefly before, but I'll just go through it again. There's a fascinating book and fascinating lectures by an individual called John Gottman, who talks extensively about marriage, actually, but obviously it applies to all relationships. Just for those of you not familiar, John Gottman is an amazing person. Him and a team of researchers. He actually didn't start off as a therapist or as a psychologist or what anyway, but he's a researcher and does research as human behavior and so on. And many, many, many years ago, he studied the success of relationships. And he studied what will make a relationship last, what will make a relationship become dysfunctional and so on. And to do the research, they set up what he called a love lab, which essentially was to set up an apartment where, like reality TV, they like set up an apartment where couples would come and stay there for a few days, act absolutely normal. The difference was that there was cameras all over the place. They would test their temperature and took blood tests and test their movement, their brain movement and so on and so forth. But essentially, obviously, with the exclusion of really, really private things, they were being videoed all the time, but the cameras were kind of hidden. It was a beautiful apartment with a beautiful view, couples really quickly slipped into sort of just acting normally for a few days and being oblivious or stopped noticing the fact that they're being filmed and being noticed and so on and so forth. So it was like a little bit of a holiday. People went with their wives and spouses and so on. And they started to observe right? And they started to observe how couples interact, and eventually they got it down to such a fine art that without intervention, if, in other words, assuming there was no intervention, they were able to predict with almost 94% accuracy which marriages were going to last and which weren't. Right? And they because they followed these couples throughout the years and actually came out, it was like pretty, pretty amazingly accurate. I tell you this because one of the things he noticed, or they noticed, they identified sort of four really, really bad practices that would almost be like a warning bell for dysfunction that was going to happen in the marriage. And then they identified a set of, I think it was four or five, really positive things that would be positive predictors to the success of a relationship. One of those things that they noticed, which became strong predictors for effective relationships and healthy relationships, is something which he calls turning towards. Turning towards. Turning towards actually was a very simple thing. So you have a couple, for example, sitting in front of the balcony, and there's a beautiful view, and there's a bit of a river or a sea, a bay, and there's a ship coming by. And I mean, this is his example. The woman is looking at the view, and she notices there's beautiful ships out there, and the man is just sort of, they're sitting at breakfast, and he's reading the newspaper. I don't know, checking the sports, or whatever the case is. And she turns to him and says, you know, wow, look at those beautiful ships out there. And then he either just sort of grunts and says, yeah, okay, nice, but doesn't turn towards, doesn't look up and turn towards, turn to notice, but keeps doing what he's doing, right? That's not turning towards. And they notice that that pattern, that those spouses, or husbands or wives, that actually exercise the simple thing of turning towards, becoming aware, in other words, noticing, that when something, you know, either make it very clear that you're in the middle of something really preoccupied and not able to be fully paying attention and be fully immersed, or you turn around and you notice and you talk and you notice the person, and therefore you notice what they're saying, you notice how they're saying it, what excitement they're saying it, you notice if they're interested in what they're talking about and are interested, and so on and so forth. And they came up with a simple technique of practicing turning towards, which essentially means turn towards and just notice, pay attention. That was a strong predictor. That was an amazing predictor for healthy relationships, which is quite amazing. Which also goes into another whole concept, which is the idea of conflict. Because one of the things they noticed in their research was that there's the presence of conflict in relationships has nothing to do with the effectiveness or the permanence or the sustainability of the relationship. In fact, his conclusion is, his finding is that conflict is good. Relationships should have conflict. Because if we never had conflict, it would be really boring and we wouldn't learn from each other. We learn from differences. And differences often express themselves in conflict and disagreements. And we learn from that. Conflict, there's nothing wrong with conflict in any relationship. What is wrong is the mismanagement of conflict. In other words, we need to have different perspectives. We need to have different opinions. But effective management of conflict is what destroys relationships, not conflict. Now, why am I bringing this in? Because, again, it has to do with how much do we understand, how much do we notice the other person. So, in relationships where people are good at noticing each other, and noticing themselves, they're able to manage conflict much, much, much better. Why? Because they're aware, again, it's about being aware of what's underneath what's going on. So for example, if you say something to me that upsets me, and I lose my cool, I lose my temper. Why am I losing my temper? Because I'm not paying attention. Meaning I know I feel all rattled, I know I feel insulted or offended, but I don't process it. I didn't stop, I didn't pause, I didn't reflect. I didn't try and notice what is actually going on within me, that I'm feeling angry. Part of mindfulness is knowing your emotions, understanding what's bothering you. Sometimes we get really upset about things and we're not even 100% sure what actually is bothering us. So part of learning to become mindful and learning to pay attention is learning what is beneath the surface. What is bothering me? Why am I so hurt? Why am I so threatened by what the other person did or said? If I think about it and process it, maybe I can reframe it a bit. Maybe I can notice it's not so bad. Maybe I can just process it a bit and put it into perspective and deal with it calmly. But more important, it's about noticing what's happening with the other person. Very, very often, the other person's reaction or the other person's speech or the other person's comment is coming because they're in pain. So noticing others means also noticing, why did that person say that? Maybe it's because they have a different perspective. Maybe they're in pain. Maybe they didn't mean it. Maybe I shouldn't judge them. Maybe I need to understand what's motivating them to act like that or to say that. So that concept of becoming more aware of what's going on with us, what's happening with other people, that awareness comes by also from the ability to stop, to pay attention, to be calm, to be more mindful, to not rush, to be in the presence of something, to think through something properly, not to be impulsive, not to act on instinct. All of that hugely enhances the ability not to eradicate conflict, but to manage conflict in a much more respectful and a much more calm way. And that's what enhances relationships beyond success. Because it is not the presence of conflict that's a problem, it's the presence of mismanaging conflict, of hurting each other, of badly judging each other. That's what destroys a relationship. But if I understand the person, if I understand how to talk to the person, if I'm paying attention to what works and what doesn't work, I'm paying attention to what you feel, what the other person feels, what they're going through, what I'm going through, if we just become aware, it becomes so much easier to manage it with respect, to manage it with calmness, and to manage it with effectiveness. So let me just end off with a few sort of practical exercises. And this I got from a chapter which and there's various different sources that we took this discussion from, but one of them is a new book I just mentioned at the beginning by Jonathan Feiner called Mindfulness of Jewish Approach, and he has a small chapter there on relationships as well. And at the end he says four things. Because at the end of each chapter, he gives like some exercises to do. So he gives four things, and I'm going to read them to you because I think they're very valuable and they're very sort of powerful. And it's just a way for us to start practicing this, because this doesn't come easy. We can talk about this, but actually it takes practice, it takes skill. It takes exercises to actually learn to become more focused on others and ourselves, to become more present, to become more calm, and to start noticing. So he says the following. He says, the next time you are with, this is number one. The next time you're with someone, try to notice, first of all, your own breath. Notice how you're feeling. And notice where your mind is going. Notice what you're thinking. I guess he means like, notice how you're acting in your mind to the other person. You know, sometimes we go into a room and we start making conclusions about people before they've even opened up their mouth. Right? That's not being mindful at all. Maybe we should just notice that we're doing that and maybe shift that a bit and start to sort of pay attention to the other person more. Then he says, try to pay attention to the person's face. Notice their skin. Notice the tone of their voice. Notice their eyes, right? Try to imagine what it's like to be in them for this moment. Try to ask yourself, how can I respond in a way that's going to be helpful to this person? Understand, in other words, noticing others means actually paying attention to them. And it means a range of things. It means the inflection in their voice. How do they sound? What kind of mood are they in today? Are they upset? Are they happy? What do their eyes look like? Just noticing people. Not an easy thing. It takes practice. Which leads into number two, of course, which says, are you listening to another person? Right? So listening is, I mean, we've talked a lot about listening. But listening really is the ultimate mindfulness. It's about listening fully to the other person without formulating responses in your own mind, right? And he says the following, notice how often you are thinking about how you want to respond. See if you can put that on hold and truly be with the other. See if you can wait a few moments before responding. Pausing before responding increases the likelihood of the speaker feeling heard and understood. So rather than replying to people in conversations instinctively, just to pause, to think a moment, the other person then feels understood. He feels that you're at least making an effort to understand them. So listening is all part of this noticing, listening properly, real listening, active listening, listening by fully being in the other person's world, of course, is all part of this mindful living in terms of relationships. And number three says, when you respond to another, try to ask yourself, Do I say what makes me sound wise, or do I say what the person needs to hear? Right? It's a real part of mindful communication. About speaking, as we talked about this a lot, but saying things that we know that people need to hear, not just what people will think, not just what things look impressive, kind of thing. And then finally, he says the following. He says, because he talks a lot about in the book about, you know, noticing our own breathing, which is a part of mindfulness exercises, and he says, notice your breath and your body. Try to think of someone with whom you are having a difficult time. Try to ask yourself why that person may be behaving in the way they do. Try to understand what circumstances in their life may have led them to act in such a way. Think of what pain they may be going through in their life. Most of the time when people are acting inappropriately, it is their way of dealing with pain. Thinking of another's pain increases compassion and tolerance. So those are just a few exercises that we do when we start to live more mindfully. We start to notice what's going on with other people. We start to notice what other people are going through. We build up that empathy. We build up that connection. And we build up that awareness of what is happening in the world of another rather than being totally absorbed in our own world. But in order to do that, in summary, we need to be aware of our own inner self. We need to be aware of the common soul. We need to be aware of the selflessness within us. We need to tap into that. We need to have a purpose. We need to have a meaning. We need to move away from selfishness and go into the realm of selflessness. And when we pay more attention, we're able to be less distracted. And as he says in that chapter, that this takes two things. You see, it takes also, going back to the very beginning of the discussion last week, it takes skill and it takes practice to remove some of the distractions. So going back to what we said last week about technology, so we need to minimize. So we need to, for example, you know, commit that when we talk to people or we're at a family meal or we're meeting with someone, that we stop looking at our phones, we stop being distracted and have this urge and need to check the latest email or WhatsApp or social media, whatever the case is. We have to remove distractions, but removing distractions, as he makes a point, is not enough. We also have to learn to deepen the presence. We have to lessen the distraction, but deepen the presence, deepen the skill of noticing and becoming aware. And when we do that, we will inevitably increase the effectiveness and the strength and the depth of the relationships that we have with other people. So that's just a few thoughts last week and this week on mindfulness and relationships. I just want to remind everyone again that this was the last one for now. And what do I do with that? Oh, here we are. Just to remind everyone that we're going to take a break for 2 weeks now. The next series is going to start on the 23rd of July. I will send around the topic when I'm confirmed what it is. As I said in the beginning, just also check the general Bina updates for where things are going to be. But in all likelihood, this particular session, because of the large crowd, thank God, is probably going to continue online for a while until we can find a solution to that issue and until things get dramatically better that we can crowd into a room again. But for now, I'll probably keep this particular one online as well as others. Some small classes will go back to Bina. But in the meantime, this will be online. So we're going to still be check the Bina updates. We're going to be having some stuff over the next 2 weeks, but it'll be much less next week because we'll be taking a little bit of a break. And this particular session will start, the Thursday morning will start again on the 23rd of July. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Shabbat shalom and all the best.